This program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This is Nancy Jones, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from What I Came to Tell You by Tommy Hayes. But I need help finishing the big weaving. She stared at the blank TV screen. Please, he said, petting Biscuit, I can't finish it without you. She glanced at him, then, pushing herself up from the couch, said, I'm not doing this for you. They worked in the bamboo forest till dark. Sudi got his flashlights and set them up, and they worked till their father, who'd had a big group of Rotarians he'd had to take through the wolf house, had come home late. He'd heard from Jesse that the bamboo forest was going to be cut down on Monday, so he'd brought home a bucket of Kentucky Fried Chicken and had taken it out to the bamboo forest so they could keep working. Amazing! Their father walked around the huge weaving as he chewed on a drumstick. He gave Grover and Sudi permission to work as late as they wanted. Grover worked till about 10 o'clock that night, and when Sudi yawned a couple of times, he told her to go inside. She shook her head, yawning again. Seeing that his sister could barely keep her eyes open, Grover looked at the weaving. Amazingly, it was nearly done. He could easily finish it tomorrow. Let's both go in, he said, cutting off his flashlights and gathering up his tools. Sunday morning, Grover was up early. Sudi had told him to wake her, but when he tried, she moaned and turned over. So he left her. She'd worked so hard last night, he knew she needed the extra sleep. As he walked out to his workshop in the early morning cold, he realized he needed a little alone time with the bamboo forest. As he began to work, he became aware that ever since his encounter with Matthew yesterday, he'd felt a little better, as if a weight he hadn't even known he carried had been, if not removed, at least lightened. Grover had been working about an hour when he heard someone crash through the bamboo, probably Sudi. She'd be mad that he hadn't woken her, but he'd let her do some of the last limbs, and she'd calm down. Sam appeared at the edge of his workshop. He couldn't remember the last time Sam had come by. "That's a huge one, Grover," Sam said, gently placing his hand on the weaving. "My dad told me that they're cutting this place down tomorrow." Grover shrugged and turned back to his work. "I should have outgrown it by now." Sam sat on the stump for a while, not talking, just watching Grover work. Finally, he said, "I'd forgot how much I like this place." He watched Grover work a while longer, then said he'd see him tomorrow at school. It wasn't long after he left that Sudi came out. She was mad he hadn't woken her, but he let her weave the last couple of limbs, and she calmed down. Then suddenly, the weaving was finished. The two of them sat on the stump, looking at it. After a while, Grover turned to his sister. "Will you pray for the bamboo forest?" "I already have," she said. "You should pray, too. The only reason I'd be praying is because I'm desperate." "God likes desperate people to pray," she said. "How come?" "Because they mean it." Chapter 21. Vincent Van Grover. Grover had finished the math test ahead of everybody else and was sketching weavings in his notebook, checking the clock on the wall. Last night, Jesse had called and told his father that the man he'd run into in the bamboo forest had called and said that he and his crew were cutting it down after lunch. "But we have school," Grover had said after his father had hung up with Jesse. "That's just as well," his father said. "I want to be there," Grover said. "Me too," Sudi said. Missing school was a big deal to his father, so Grover was surprised when he said he'd come get them out of school at noon tomorrow and bring them home in time to watch. That night, Grover had dreamed an army of bulldozers rumbled into the bamboo forest, flattened it, and then gouged out the ground, tearing the bamboo up by its rhizomes. He woke very early, dressed, and arrived in the bamboo forest at the first purplish hint of dawn. He walked along the hallway, touching the weavings. Stopping in front of the big weaving, Sudie had helped him finish last night. He sat on the stump in the middle of his workshop and listened to the wind rattle the bamboo. He'd been coming here since he was barely old enough to walk. He'd probably spent more time in the bamboo forest than he'd spent in his own house. At one point, he smelled sandalwood, and after a while, he heard his father call for him. "Coming," he called. Then he placed his hand flat on the stump and said, "Goodbye, old friend," and as he did, the breeze blew and the bamboo gave a long, soft rattle, almost like a sigh. When Grover's father appeared in his classroom doorway with Sudie, Grover felt a pit open in his stomach, like when the nurse at his doctor's office came into the waiting room and announced his name. Grover went back to the cloakroom for his knapsack and his coat. As he was walking out, Mrs. Caswell came over, put her hand on his shoulder, and said, "We're with you." When they got home, they walked up the street to where a couple of big trucks, loaded with chainsaws and other cutting tools, were parked in front of the bamboo forest. They'd left Biscuit shut up in the house. The men, who were all Mexican Americans and who wore orange vests, hadn't started. They sat on the curb eating sandwiches and drinking from their thermoses and talking in Spanish. Jesse was there with them, talking to the man who Grover guessed was the boss. He was a big man with huge shoulders and a big belly, too. He wasn't Mexican. "Harold Sluter," Jesse said. "This is Walter Johnston and his daughter, Sudie, and his son, Grover." "Pleased to meet y'all," the man said, shaking their father's hand. He had kind eyes and a gentle smile. "Sorry about this." He nodded toward the bamboo forest. "Looks like you've spent a whole lot of time down there, making it your own." "A job is a job," their father said. Maybe he was thinking of his own job and whether he would keep it much longer. Jesse checked his watch and looked toward the street. "Y'all want to walk through one more time?" He turned to the big man. "Mind if they walk through?" "Go ahead," the man said. "We've waited this long. We can wait a few more minutes. The boys won't argue about a little longer lunch break." Grover, Sudie, and their father had started into the bamboo forest when there was a screech out on the street and the slam of a car door. "Lunsford," their father said under his breath. "What's going on, Sluter?" Mr. Lunsford said, walking up to the big man. "I said I wanted that bamboo down first thing this morning." "We didn't finish up the job at your house till midday," he said, "and the boys had to have lunch." "What are you doing here, Johnston?" Mr. Lunsford said, turning to Grover and Sudie. "We've already been through this." "The kids wanted to say goodbye," their father said. "Oh, good grief," said Mr. Lunsford. "The way y'all act, you'd think I'm cutting down the rainforest. It's a scrubby old patch of bamboo, like a million other patches of bamboo around this town." "Kids have been playing here for generations," Jesse said. Mr. Lunsford turned to Mr. Sluter. "Well, what are you waiting for?" Mr. Sluter nodded to the men, who got up slowly, putting away their lunch pails. A chainsaw started up, and then a couple more. The men headed toward the bamboo forest. Jesse kept glancing at his watch and back toward the road. Sudie buried her head in her father's arms. Grover made himself watch as the bamboo fell away from the saw blades, like the men were cutting through butter. The bamboo fell around them as they moved deeper into the cane. Grover watched as one of the men discovered the entrance to the hallway of tapestries. The man disappeared down the hallway, and his chainsaw went silent. The man called out in Spanish to the other workers and waved them over. They all disappeared down the hallway. Grover heard their excited voices, but could understand only a few words. "Increíble! Milagroso! Es muy bonita!" "What's going on, Sluter?" Mr. Lunsford said. "Why have they stopped?" Mr. Sluter disappeared into the bamboo forest. Grover heard him talking to them in Spanish. Finally, Mr. Sluter ambled back up. "They like what all the boys done down in there. They're saying it reminds them of some of the weaving from back home. They say he's the real thing. Sluder, Lunsford said. Mr. Sluder nodded curtly. Yes, sir. He disappeared back into the bamboo forest. After a while, Mr. Sluder led the men out of the bamboo, and one by one they started up their chainsaws. They cut slower than before, like their hearts weren't in it. Still, they were doing it, cutting down the bamboo forest, foot by foot, yard by yard. It wouldn't be long before they'd be cutting away the tapestries. They'd cut about 12 feet into the grove when Grover felt the ground rumble beneath him. He turned around, expecting to see bulldozers. A long line of school buses pulled up along the road. The buses all said Isaac Claxton Elementary School on the sides. Children streamed off the buses and headed toward the bamboo forest. Mr. Sluder shouted something to the men in Spanish, and the men all turned off their saws as the children poured past them and disappeared into the bamboo forest. "Hold on there," Mr. Lunsford said, standing in front of the children, holding his arm out like a traffic cop. But the kids just flowed past him like a river around a rock. "We thought it was time for a field trip, Commissioner Lunsford," Mrs. Caswell said, as she and several teachers stepped past Mr. Lunsford. As soon as the children entered the hallway of tapestries, they quieted, like they'd walked into a church. Sudie joined her class, showing them down the hallway, like a tour guide. The kids walked along the hallway, gaping at the weavings. "Whoa, it's like art or something. Looks like it's part of the bamboo. The bamboo grew some art. Who did all these?" "Sudie's brother." "Grover did all these? They look kind of like that Starry Night guy. Van Gogh. Vincent Van Gogh. Vincent Van Grover." Laughter. "Vincent Van Grover. Vincent Van Grover." The bamboo forest rang with children's voices chanting, "Vincent Van Grover. Vincent Van Grover. Vincent Van Grover." The workers were all standing off to the side, watching and talking among themselves in Spanish. Hearing Mr. Lunsford speaking angrily, Grover had walked back to where his father and Jesse stood, facing the commissioner. "You planned this," Mr. Lunsford said, "didn't you, Johnston? Well, none of it makes a bit of difference. It's still my land, and as soon as those kids are out of there..." Grover heard the slam of more car doors. He looked up to see Byron from Reader's Corner getting out of a car. And Little Bit, with several of the Wolf House tour guides, getting out of another. Neighbors from the neighborhood walked from down the street. Grover noticed several store owners from the Grove Arcade and other downtown stores. "So, Grover, on such an important occasion as your opening, why aren't you wearing your new coat?" "It was Mr. Berkowitz. Impress the girls and give me a little advertising." Grover noticed a glimmer of yellow at the back of the old man's neck. He was wearing his measuring tape underneath his coat. "Where did all these people come from?" Grover looked at his father, who was looking at Jesse. "I do a lot of yards," Jesse said, looking a little sheepish. "Oh, look who's here." Mira's mother, the mayor of Asheville, was walking down the path. "Oh, good," Mr. Lunsford said, turning to their father. "She can see firsthand the mischief you and your buddy have been up to." "Mayor, you're just in time," Mr. Lunsford said, taking her by the elbow. Mira, who'd been down in the bamboo forest, ran up to her mother. "Mama, you need to come see what Grover's done down here."
I've heard,
the mayor said. "So then you know that Johnston's kids have been..." Lunsford began. "Good to see you, Walt." The mayor shook their father's hand. "I hear the Wolf House has been revived thanks to the Thomas Wolfe Christmas." "But, Mayor," Mr. Lunsford interrupted. "Commissioner Lunsford," the mayor said, taking Mr. Lunsford's hand, "I wanted to come down and personally thank you for your generosity. I just learned of your plans to donate this land to the city."
"Donate? Is that not accurate?" the mayor asked. "I was told..."
"Look," Daniel Pivo called out. "Channel 13 is here." A dressed-up news anchor and a man carrying a camera got out of a van that said News 13 along the side. They came down the path toward them. "Hello, Mayor and Commissioner Lunsford. You're just the people I was hoping to see," the newswoman said. "We're here about the land the commissioner is donating for a children's park."
"Children's park?" Mr. Lunsford said.
"Do you mind if we ask you a few questions?" the woman said. The cameraman had turned his bright lights on Mr. Lunsford. A crowd of kids and adults gathered to watch. The newswoman turned toward the camera and said, "We're here on Edgemont Road, where a group of children and teachers from Isaac Claxton Elementary, as well as people from across Asheville, have gathered to celebrate Commissioner Lunsford's donation of his property for a new children's park." She turned to Mr. Lunsford, whose face had gone pale. "Commissioner, why did you decide to donate this valuable piece of property to the city?" Mr. Lunsford looked at the camera and smiled a weak smile. "The commissioner is too modest to say it," Jesse said, stepping into the camera light and putting his hand on Commissioner Lunsford's shoulder, "but this whole thing is his idea." "And who are you, sir?" the woman tilted the microphone in Jesse's direction. "Jesse Cole," he said, "a fan of Commissioner Lunsford."
"A fan?" Grover mouthed to his father.
In his capacity as commissioner, Mr. Lunsford had noticed that development was swallowing up empty lots where children once played, so he decided to set an example, and instead of selling this lot, he decided to donate this valuable piece of property as a Christmas gift to the children of the neighborhood. Different expressions flitted across the commissioner's face: puzzlement, then anger, then astonishment, then resignation. "A Christmas gift to the city," the newswoman repeated. "We also have on hand Mayor Hodges." The woman motioned for the mayor to step up to the microphone. "Mayor, I have to assume you're excited about the commissioner's donation." The woman held up the microphone to Mira's mother. "Most certainly," the mayor said. "It is an extraordinary act of generosity and kindness. Clearly, Commissioner Lunsford puts the children of Asheville first." "Commissioner, do you have anything to say?" The woman held out the microphone. Grover had noticed that the commissioner had been smiling bigger and bigger since Jesse had said that about a Christmas gift to the city. As if he was already reading tomorrow's headlines in the Asheville Citizen Times, "Commissioner donates Christmas gift to Asheville's children." He leaned into the microphone. "I remember when I was a little fella, we kids ran around in the woods all day. We didn't need toys. We didn't need video games. We didn't need a thing but our imaginations. Well, there aren't all that many woods left to run around in anymore, so I figured what better way to make use of this land, this valuable land, I might add, than to donate it to Asheville's most treasured resource." He paused and patted the head of a little girl who happened to be standing beside him, "our children." "Commissioner," the newswoman asked, "do you envision this as a playground with swings and slides and other playground equipment?" Mr. Lunsford opened his mouth as if to speak, but Jesse stepped up. "The commissioner thought it would be best to leave the land as it is. Kids need some left-alone places, a child-life refuge, you might say." The commissioner eyed Jesse. "A child-life refuge?" the newswoman asked, tilting the microphone toward Mr. Lunsford, but Jesse leaned in. "The commissioner is too humble to admit it, but he came up with the idea himself," Jesse said. "In fact, he's going to propose to the commissioners in their next meeting that the city sponsor a child-life refuge program through which landowners can donate undeveloped land to set aside for children to play in and receive a tax write-off." "What a fascinating concept," the newswoman said. "How on earth did you come up with such an idea, Commissioner?" Mr. Lunsford looked at Jesse as if he was too stunned to talk, but then he turned to the microphone and said, "It just came to me." The mayor said a few more things, and then the interview was over. As soon as the camera lights went off, the commissioner sort of collapsed like a balloon losing air. He glared at Jesse and seemed about to say something, but then all the people who'd been watching the interview came up to shake the commissioner's hand and pat him on the back, and more than one of them said, "You have my vote next year." Grover watched as the men with the orange vest loaded their chainsaws and weed-eaters and sling blades back onto their trucks. Grover felt a hand on his shoulder. Mr. Sluder leaned over and said under his breath, "Between you and me, this is one job I don't mind leaving unfinished." He climbed into his pickup truck and pulled away, and the rest of the big trucks followed him. As Grover watched them drive off, it finally hit him. The bamboo forest wasn't going to be cut down. He felt a rush of air and light, like a door had been flung open somewhere inside him, a door that had been closed so tight for so long that he'd forgotten it was there. Sudi grabbed Grover's hands and was jumping up and down. "I can't believe it." Grover couldn't help laughing. "I'd like to show y'all something," Jesse said. To the newswoman and the cameraman, "Do you have a minute?" Jesse motioned for Sudi and Grover to follow them. Sudi started after them, but Grover stayed where he was. It was all he could do to try and comprehend what had just happened. The bamboo forest was about to be cut down, then it wasn't. Something was about to be dead, then it wasn't. How could that be? That's when he noticed that Jesse was leading the newswoman in the direction of his weavings. "Why is he showing her my work?" Grover asked Mira, who happened to be standing beside him. "Grover," Mira said, "your weavings aren't a secret anymore." She nodded toward the bamboo forest, where a long line of children and adults waited to walk through the hallway of tapestries. "Hey, where are you going?" Feeling too much, Grover walked out of the bamboo forest and headed up the street. He passed by the parked school buses and the news van and all the cars lining both sides of the street. Even as he got farther up the street, he could still hear the crowd. It sounded like a huge party being held in the bamboo forest. Grover never felt comfortable at parties. He turned in at the riverside gates and walked along a path, his hands stuck deep in his coat pockets. What had just happened? Jesse had saved the bamboo forest. That was pretty clear. Grover couldn't have been more relieved. But what was the uneasy feel underneath it all? Instead of heading for his mother's grave, Grover stopped in front of Thomas Wolfe's headstone. "Feels so strange," Grover said to the writer's headstone. "All this attention." Grover sat down on the little wall that enclosed the Wolfe family plot. He needed to think. He was, of course, glad that the men hadn't cut down the bamboo forest. Still, something gnawed at him. He didn't mind family and friends looking at his weavings, or even his teachers, really, but having half of Asheville walk around in the bamboo forest looking at his work was unnerving, even kind of painful. Something private that had been between him and the bamboo was not his anymore. His weavings and the world he'd created them in had gotten away from him. Crows cawed from a nearby hemlock, and a breeze swayed its shaggy limbs. Grover sat there, for he wasn't sure how long. After a while, the murmur of the crowd softened. Car doors banged shut out in the street, and then the ground shook as buses headed back to Claxton. People were leaving, but they were taking something with them. He realized now what Jesse must have known for some time. The only way to save the bamboo forest had been to lose it. That night, Grover had trouble sleeping. He kept going over all that had happened in the bamboo forest. It was too much, so he slipped out of bed, dressed, grabbed his flashlights and his toolbox, tiptoed through the dark house, opened the door very quietly, and headed out to the bamboo forest. But as he walked toward it, he noticed light flitting through the bamboo, and for a moment his heart stopped. A fire! He ran, but as he neared the bamboo, he realized it wasn't a fire, but a flashlight. He slowed, and moving as quietly as he could, stepped into the hallway of tapestries. Light glowed from around the curved hallway. For a moment, he didn't recognize the man in a coat, shining a flashlight on a tapestry, was his own father. His father studied the tapestry, then walked up to it and gently ran his hand over it. His father saw him. He looked almost embarrassed, as if Grover had caught him at something. "What are you doing out here?" his father asked. "Couldn't sleep," Grover said, walking up beside him. "Thought I might do a little work." he set down his toolbox. "An eventful day," his father said. He shined the flashlight on the next tapestry. "These weavings of yours are really quite remarkable." His father sounded as if he was seeing them for the first time, and in all the years Grover had been making things, never had he seen his father pay this kind of attention to anything he'd made. "So much to notice," his father said, as they walked along the hallway, looking at each one by his father's flashlight. There was something about seeing them in the dark out here with his father that gave Grover a whole new appreciation of his weavings. Already they felt like they'd been done by someone else. "So intricate," his father said, stopping in front of another one. "The more you look, the more you see." As they came to the end of the hall, Grover sighed and looked around him. "I can't believe Jesse was able to save this place." His father frowned. "Jesse didn't save it. You did." "Me?" Grover said. His father pointed the flashlight beam along the hallway of tapestries. "If it wasn't for your artwork, no one would have ever understood the importance of the bamboo forest. No one would have understood what can grow out of a place like this." It hadn't occurred to Grover that he'd played any part in saving the bamboo forest. Earlier today, as all the students and teachers and neighbors and friends had filed through this hallway, he'd felt like a bystander, a helpless bystander at that. The idea that his weavings might have helped save this place cast a new light on all the years he'd been coming out here, driven by nothing more than the urge to put things together. Without Grover understanding quite how, his work had taken on a life of its own. A siren started up in the distance. A dog barked somewhere, and the bamboo rustled with the breeze. Standing there with his father, Grover felt like he'd moved to the center of something. His mind, which had been racing in so many directions all day, was suddenly still. His father yawned. "I better hit the hay. You staying out here to work a little?" Grover couldn't help yawning himself, and as he did, a welcome wave of exhaustion came over him. "I'll come with you," he said. "After all," he reminded himself, "the bamboo forest will be here tomorrow." The next day, Grover rolled the wheelbarrow to the cemetery to clear off the remnants of the tapestries he'd carried over to their mother's grave these many months. Mostly what was left were the bamboo frames, which seemed to be pretty much intact. He had the idea that he could recycle them and weave in new green leaves in the spring. He'd loaded up the wheelbarrow and was on his way out of the cemetery, but when he passed by the wolf plot, he noticed a letter propped up against Thomas Wolfe's headstone. Seeing no one around, he picked up the note. It was addressed to Mr. Thomas Wolfe, and it was sealed. He paused. The notes weren't usually sealed, which made him think it was private, and he started to set it back down. But before he knew what he was doing, he tore open the letter. Written in blocked and shaky print, it said, "Dear Mr. Wolfe, Clara, my wife of 52 years, died a few weeks ago. She loved your books. She read them and reread them every few years, like she was revisiting a close friend. She tried to get me to read them, but I was never a big reader. Even so, now that she's gone, I've been reading Look Homeward, Angel. It's slow going, but sometimes I'll come across a comment Clara scribbled in the margins, and it'll be like hearing her voice. She's buried nearby. I thought you'd want to know you have an admirer in the neighborhood. Gratefully, Paul Fallon." Reading someone else's mail? Grover whirled around and found Matthew standing there. "I'd say you have a pretty high startle response," Matthew said, pushing his wire-rimmed glasses up on his nose. "I thought you were gone." Grover's heart pounded as he stuck the letter back in the envelope and leaned it against Wolfe's headstone. He felt irritated, even angry. He picked up the wheelbarrow and started walking quickly toward the entrance. "I came by to tell you something," Matthew said, walking along beside him. Grover didn't slow down. He didn't want to hear whatever Matthew had to tell him. Every time this guy opened his mouth, Grover's world was turned upside down. "You aren't to blame for what happened to your mother," Matthew said. Grover stopped the wheelbarrow.
"Because you are?"
"No," Matthew said.
"Then who's to blame?"
"I was in the middle of a history exam last week," he said. "One essay question was, who was responsible for dropping the atomic bomb on Hiroshima? At first, I thought, how could that be an essay question? It was a two-word answer, Harry Truman. But then I got to thinking that the pilots and crew of the Enola Gay actually dropped the bomb. Or you could blame Einstein for writing Roosevelt about the possibility of such a bomb in the first place. Or you could blame Oppenheimer or the guys at Oak Ridge. Or you could blame the American people. Who didn't want more GIs dying on foreign soil? Or you could even argue that the Japanese brought it on themselves. You could argue that all of humanity dropped that bomb. You could say everybody was to blame. Or, he looked at Grover with his eyebrows raised, you could say that nobody was to blame. "I don't see what the atomic bomb has to do with who killed my mother," Grover said. "When terrible things happen, we want to blame somebody, even if that somebody is us. But what if nobody is to blame?" "Somebody definitely dropped the atom bomb," Grover said.
"Maybe so," Matthew said.
"But does that mean they're to blame?"
"I don't know what you're talking about."
Grover started pushing the wheelbarrow. A big flock of crows flew over them, veered away to a corner of the cemetery, landing high in a hemlock, making a loud ruckus, as if unsettled by something. Grover and Matthew passed a few family plots and stopped in front of a new headstone that Matthew nodded to. Clara Norton Fallon, March 10, 1935, to November 29, 2011. The letter writer's wife. She died just a few weeks ago. "What I came to tell you is this," Matthew said. "Sometimes things just happen."
"Maybe you just want to feel better," Grover said.
"Is that a bad thing to want?" Matthew asked. They walked out the cemetery gates, where a faded gray Honda Civic wagon sat parked. The car was crammed with boxes and clothes and piles of what must have been history books.
"I thought you said you'd stopped driving," Grover asked,
"until I figured out that nobody else was going to get me to where I needed to go." A thought occurred to Grover. "Was this the car that..." He touched the hood. Matthew sighed, held his hand out to Grover, and said, "So long." Grover looked at Matthew's hand, but couldn't bring himself to shake it.
"I don't blame you," Matthew said,
then got in his car and started it, the muffler rattling. He was backing up when all of a sudden Grover ran after him, banging on the driver's side window. Matthew stopped the car and rolled down his window. Grover looked at him. "So long." Matthew pushed his glasses up on his nose and nodded. Grover watched the car rattle down the street. Even after Matthew had driven out of sight, his words hung in the cold air, taking real form, so that Grover could read them as clearly as if they'd been etched into a headstone. "Sometimes things just happen." Chapter 22. Be That Way. It was the last day of school before Christmas holidays. Grover had delivered some reports to the main office for Mrs. Caswell, and on his way back, Miss Snyder waved him into her office and handed him an article she'd cut out of the Citizen Times.
"I figured you couldn't have too many copies," she said. "I thought they did a great job."
As part of the big segment about Mr. Lunsford donating the land for the park, the TV people had done a tiny bit on Grover and his weavings. Then the Citizen Times had sent out a reporter and a photographer and run a big 2-page article with color pictures. In the past couple of days, a lot of people had come by to see his weavings. At first, he didn't like being interrupted, but as more people came by, he became kind of used to it. The more people looked at his weavings, the more it felt like the weavings weren't his anymore, like they belonged to everybody who came to see them. What he figured out was that the only weaving that really mattered to him was the weaving he was working on at the moment. "I have something else for you," Miss Snyder said. She went to the wall behind her desk, took down his mother's calendar, and handed it to him. He flipped through the pages, looking at Van Gogh's paintings and his mother's neat pencil handwriting. "How are you doing?" Miss Snyder asked. "Okay," he said. The Starry Night was the picture for December. He always loved that painting. All the circles of light against the dark made it feel alive. "It'll be our first Christmas without her," he was surprised to hear himself say. Miss Snyder didn't say anything for a little bit. "What will that be like?" "Hard," Grover said, "at least for Sudie." He felt her looking at him. He sighed and said, "Hard for me, too." They talked a while longer, and toward the end of their conversation, Miss Snyder handed him a little card with her name and cell phone number on it. "If Sudie or you need anything over the holidays, or you just want to talk, give me a call." "Okay," he said, knowing this was something Miss Snyder probably didn't do for most kids. He put the card in his pocket and started to walk out, but then he turned around and, hardly knowing what he was doing, hugged her. Then, feeling his face flush, he picked up the calendar and the article and walked quickly down the hall, not turning around when she called him to wish him a Merry Christmas. He walked back toward his classroom in a daze. What was that all about? Since when did he go around hugging counselors? He walked into his classroom and sat down at his desk in a daze. "Be that way," said a familiar voice. "Don't say a word." Grover whirled around and for a minute thought he was seeing things, because there, right back in her old desk, was Emma Lee. Grover and Sudie had planned to meet their father at the Wolf House to celebrate the end of school, and they talked Clay and Emma Lee into coming with them. As they walked up Montford, Clay explained that the Round Trees were moving back to Asheville. He said that Emma Lee and he, and even their grandmother, had been saying to their mother that they should move back, and Leela had seemed to be thinking about it. But after that night, when we all went to Bean Street's after the Christmas waltz, and Mama and your daddy didn't hardly talk, and Grover walked out, and your daddy went after him. "What was that about, anyway?" Emma Lee asked Grover. "All of a sudden, you just got up and left." "Anyhow," Clay said, "after that night at Bean Street's, Mama seemed dead set on not moving back, but your daddy started calling." "He called every night at 10 o'clock on the dot," Emma Lee said. Grover remembered hearing his father on the phone in the kitchen with the door closed. He thought he was making work phone calls, although he remembered thinking he was calling people pretty late. He also remembered thinking how his father laughed more than he usually did when he made work phone calls. But then he'd been laughing more in general since Mr. Lunsford had stopped threatening to close the Wolf House. "At first, Mama and your daddy hardly said a word," Clay said, "but your daddy kept calling, and each time Mama got off the phone, she seemed a little better. Then one morning last week, she said we were moving back." As they passed Reader's Corner, Byron rapped on the window and waved at them. She pointed to the article she taped to the window. There were several photos, including one of Grover and Sudie standing in front of the biggest weaving. "Hey, we read that," Emma Lee said. "You're famous." She elbowed Grover. They'd walked a little farther up Montford, and as they passed Video Life, the clerk with the pointy beard came out. "Your weavings blew my mind," he said to Sudie and Grover. He handed Sudie a little wrapped package. "Merry Christmas." Sudie, being Sudie, she immediately unwrapped it. "Fantastic, Mr. Fox." The sight of the DVD sent Grover's heart racing. Maybe this was the very copy of the movie their mother had been on her way to pick up. The very copy Grover himself should have picked up the day before. "We don't have any money with us," Grover said to the clerk. "It's a gift," the clerk said. "But..." "Please," Sudie said, "can't we keep it?" "We over-ordered copies," the clerk said. Then he leaned over and, lowering his voice, said to Grover, "I was working here the day your mother was hit. I was the one who answered the phone when your father called, asking if your mother had come in yet. Your mother and I used to have long talks about movies. She had excellent taste." "Can I keep the movie?" Sudie asked, studying the back of the DVD case. Grover looked at the clerk, and then back at Sudie, and as he did, he heard Matthews, "Sometimes things just happen." Something lifted in him. "I guess it won't hurt anything," he said. Sudie hadn't waited for his answer to start tucking the DVD into her knapsack. When they reached the Wolf House, Little Bit told them their father had someone in his office and that they could wait in the break room, that she'd bought a brand new box of powdered doughnuts. The Wolf House wasn't as busy as it had been the day Grover's class had come. Attendance had gone down with school about to be out. Even so, there were two church groups and several families. Mr. Lunsford walked in the front door as they headed to the break room. "Come on," Grover whispered, motioning for them to hurry up. Just as Grover thought he'd made it into the safety of the break room, someone caught his arm. "Saw the big spread in the paper," said Mr. Lunsford, like he was impressed. He started talking to Little Bit. Grover couldn't believe Mr. Lunsford was making small talk with her, asking her how her day had been, asking about her family. Grover's father had told him that Mr. Lunsford was a changed man. Mr. Lunsford had been all over the TV and the newspaper for donating the land for the children's park. The headline in the paper had read, "Generous Commissioner, a Model of Christmas Spirit." The Atlanta and Charlotte papers had run articles about county commissioners passing the Child Life Refuge Program. The Associated Press had even run an article, and Mr. Lunsford had been getting calls from all over the country to come speak about the Child Life Refuge Program. Grover's father said Mr. Lunsford had gotten so much attention for being the generous commissioner that he had become, well, generous. Only after talking with Little Bit a while about her grandchildren did Mr. Lunsford ask if their father was in. "He has someone with him," Little Bit said. "He has an appointment after this one as well." "Tell him that Delbert stopped by to see if he needed anything," Mr. Lunsford said, wished Little Bit a nice day, and left. Little Bit shook her head. "I can't get over how much that man's changed." His father stuck his head out of his office, whispering, "Is he gone?" "He said to tell you that Delbert stopped by," said Little Bit. "Why were you hiding?" Sudie asked. "He comes by 2 or 3 times a day, asking if he can do anything," their father said. "I'm starting to think I prefer the old Lunsford." Leela came out from their father's office, wearing her nurse's uniform. She must have come over from St. Joseph's, and they'd met for lunch. She looked sort of embarrassed and happy at the same time. The 6 of them walked over to Bean Street's and ordered hot chocolates. And, like the last time, it was crowded, and the 4 kids sat at one table, and Leela and their father sat across the room. Unlike the last time, Leela and their father talked, and when they weren't talking, they were just looking each other in the eyes. Grover was pretty weirded out. When a family got up from the checkerboard table, Clay and Sudie went over to play, leaving Grover and Emily alone. "They sure seem different," Grover said. "You can say that again," Emily said. "They sure seem very funny." Emily sipped her hot chocolate. "I never thanked you for coming to the Christmas waltz," Grover said. "No, you didn't. Thank you," he said. She looked up at him. "I mean it," he said. "It was a really nice night," she said, "the nicest night I think I've ever had." "The kids still talk about your grandmother's dress," Grover said. Emily's face reddened a little. Grover's father burst into laughter at something Leela had said. "It's strange for me, too, you know," Emily said, cutting her eyes toward their parents. Grover didn't know what to say. He felt selfish, having not given much thought about how it might be strange for Emily and Clay, too. "Still," Emily said, her face softening, "your father's a good man." "I guess so," Grover said. "No guessing about it," she said. "I know a good man when I see one." Emily looked at Grover. "Did God tell your mother it was okay to move back?" he asked. Mama hasn't brought up God much lately." Out of the corner of his eye, Grover saw his father lean over and cover Leela's hand with his own for a moment. "Guess this means we'll have to be just friends," Grover said. "Were we ever anything else?" Grover felt his face burning. "Well, I guess I just..." Emily laughed, and he knew she was messing with him. But then her face went serious, and she leaned toward him, and lowering her voice, said, "Grover, you and me aren't just friends." "We aren't?" "Never will be. No, we're good friends, and no matter what happens," she glanced toward their parents, "we'll stay that way." "Are you going to marry Leela?" Sudi asked, carrying the wreath. Their father laughed. It was Christmas Eve afternoon, a clear but warm December day. Their father and Sudi had bought a wreath with a red bow on it at the grocery store, and on their way over to Riverside Cemetery had stopped by and gotten Grover, who had been working in the bamboo forest. "No, sweetheart," their father said, pulling her against him. "You're not?" Sudi said. "You sound a little disappointed," he said. "I like Leela," Sudi said. "I like her a lot." "What about you, Grover?" their father asked. "Do you like Leela?" Grover shrugged. As they walked out of the bamboo forest, they passed by the big wooden sign the city workmen had installed where the for sale signs had stood. The sign read, "Lunsford Park, a child life refuge." Biscuit walked over to the sign, sniffed around it for a minute, then lifted his leg and peed. They walked through Riverside, and when they reached their mother's grave, Grover moved aside what was left of his old weavings, and then Sudi leaned the wreath against the headstone. "Why aren't you and Leela getting married?" Sudi asked. "We're just getting to know each other." "Did you and Mommy have to get to know each other?" Sudi asked. Grover rolled his eyes. "Yes, we did." "How long did that take?" Sudi asked. "A couple of years," their father said, looking at the gravestone, his face emptying out. "A couple of years? Oh, that's forever." Then their father said, "I want you and Grover to know that if I ever do want to marry someone, I would never do it without y'all's permission." "Our permission?" Sudi smiled like she thought this was silly. "Parents are the ones who give permission." "Not in this case," said their father. "Would you need us to sign a permission slip?" Sudi grinned. Grover hadn't been surprised that Sudi had asked if they might get married. Leela and their father had been going for walks every evening after supper, and a couple of times they'd gone out to supper alone. It all made Grover feel pretty unsettled. But he had to admit that his father had seemed happier and more like his old self. Grover kind of understood what his father was feeling. At night, whenever Grover went out to the kitchen for a glass of milk and some Oreos, or a late-night bowl of cereal, he'd stop by the front window to see the lights on in the Round Tree's house. Just knowing they were over there made him sleep better. "Guess we better get back," their father said, glancing at his watch. "I told Jesse we'd come over at 6. They were having Christmas Eve dinner at Jesse's, and the Round Trees were coming too, along with Mrs. Sparks, who'd come down from Bakersville and was spending Christmas with them. Grover turned to their father, wanting to offer him something. "I'm glad the Round Trees moved back," he said. Their father put his hand on Grover's shoulder. They started to leave, but Sudi ran back, leaned down, and kissed their mother's headstone. "Merry Christmas, Mama." She squatted there for a minute, but her eyes didn't redden and her lips didn't tremble. Biscuit came up beside her and sat. "You know that dream I used to have?" Sudi said, standing back up. "The one where Mama gets in the car with us?" Grover asked. "Yeah," Sudi said. "I don't have that dream anymore."
"You don't?" Grover asked.
"I didn't know you'd been having a dream about your mother," their father said. "Just about every night since she died," Sudi said. Well, where have I been?
Away, Sudie said. You've been away.
She looked at the headstone for a second. But it's all right, she said, taking Grover's hand. My brother's been here the whole time.
This concludes this reading of What I Came to Tell You by Tommy Hayes. I hope you've enjoyed it. Now, some acknowledgments from the author. I am deeply indebted to Abigail DeWitt, a fine writer and critic, who read several drafts and who believed in Grover as his story emerged. Sam Hodges, who has been a dear friend and writer colleague since our freshman year at Furman University, gave crucial suggestions as I revised. And Kathy Sheldon, with her heat-seeking literary vision, helped me see the book it could become. I knew I was onto something when my agent, Needy Madden, at Sterling Lord Literistic, told me she missed her subway stop while reading the manuscript, and I'm forever grateful that she found Grover such a wonderful home. My editor, Regina Griffin, has been nothing but a joy to work with, and I cannot thank her and the attentive staff at Edgemont USA enough for insisting What I Came to Tell You become its own best self. Tommy Hayes dedicates this book for Max and Ruth, who disappeared for hours into the neighbor's bamboo thicket, often staying till dark, and for Connie, who waited as patiently as a mother could to call them in for supper. This book was first published in 2013. This paperback edition was published in 2014. Copyright Tommy Hayes, 2013. The Thomas Wolfe Memorial is a North Carolina State Historic Site operated by the Division of State Historic Sites and Properties. This work has not been prepared, manufactured, approved, or licensed by the Division of State Historic Sites and Properties or the State of North Carolina. Neither the author of this work nor the publisher is in any way affiliated with the Division of State Historic Sites and Properties. Tommy Hayes is the director of the Great Smokies Writing Program and a lecturer at the University of North Carolina, Asheville. His most recent novel for adults, The Pleasure Was Mine, was an SIBA fiction finalist, featured on NPR's Radio Reader and SCETV Radio's Southern Read, and was selected for several community-wide reading programs in various cities and counties, including Greenville, South Carolina, and Greensboro, North Carolina. He lives in Asheville with his family. Now, a reader's guide for classrooms and reading groups, written by Pat Scales, children's literature consultant. Pre-reading activity. Invite a counselor or a psychologist to speak to the class or group about the five stages of grief. Ask the speaker to address the following: how everyone grieves differently, how long it takes to move through all stages of grief, if some grieving people skip a stage, where to go for help. Allow time for students to ask questions, then have them write a short response to the points made by the speaker. Instruct them to refer to their notes as they read the novel. 1. Describe the Johnston family. What did Grover's mother do to encourage family unity? Discuss how this unity is shattered when she dies. How is Jesse a parent figure for Grover and Sudie? Why is their father content to allow Jesse to take over this role? 2. Dealing with grief is one of the main themes of the novel. People grieve in different ways. Compare and contrast how the following characters deal with their grief: Grover, Sudie, Walter Johnston, Emily, Leela, and Matthew. What does Grover learn about grief from his relationship with Emily? Discuss Grover's reaction when he sees his father crying. Debate whether Grover feels as if he has happened on a private moment. Why is crying important in the grieving process? 3. Guilt is another underlying theme in the story.
Why does Grover feel guilty about his mother's death? Discuss Grover's thoughts when he learns that Matthew, Jesse's assistant, was the driver of the car that hit his mother. How does Matthew spend the months after the accident seeking redemption? The inscription on Grover's mother's grave reads, "We are not what we think, the Buddha." How might this quote have special meaning for Matthew and Grover at the end of the novel? Matthew accidentally took Grover's mother's life. How does he give Grover his life back? 4. Grover thinks that his mother seems more with him now that she is gone. How is this especially true when he's in his workshop in the bamboo forest? Discuss the symbolism of the teardrop Christmas ornament. How does it represent absence and presence? There are times when Grover feels gone. How is this feeling related to his mother's death? Explain how Walter Johnston contributes to the gone feeling in his son. 5. Anger is one of the stages of grief. Discuss how Grover and his father express their anger toward each other. Why does Grover's father smash Grover's workshop and the weavings? What is his father feeling when he returns to retrieve Grover's toolbox from the forest? Explain how Sudi deals with these fits of anger between father and son. 6. Grover is stunned when Clay refers to his weavings as art. How does this change the way Grover sees his work? Grover tells Emma Lee that he doesn't believe in God. Discuss what she means when she responds, "Maybe your head doesn't, but your hands sure do." How is this an ultimate compliment from Emma Lee? At the end of the novel, Jesse invites people to see Grover's work. Explain the following quote. The more people looked at his weavings, the more it felt like the weavings weren't his anymore. 7. Contrast Grover's passion for his bamboo weavings with his father's passion for Thomas Wolfe. How do they both hide behind their passion? Neither father nor son understands the other's passion. At what point do they learn to appreciate each other's work? 8. Discuss Grover's reaction when he hears his father and Leela in the guest room together on the night of the fire. Why does his father say that he was irresponsible and selfish to let that happen between him and Leela? Explain what he means when he tells Grover, "I should have been there." Debate whether his father is referring to the night of the fire, the day Grover's mother was killed, or all the times in between. 9. Grover doesn't like the word feel. Grover's father encourages him to speak with Miss Snyder, the counselor who took his mother's position at school. Explain why Grover thinks that Sudi needs Miss Snyder, but he doesn't. Discuss whether Grover is uncomfortable with Miss Snyder because she occupies his mother's office or because he is reluctant to talk about his feelings. Explain Miss Snyder's skill in dealing with kids like Grover. For more questions, please refer to a copy of the book. Many thanks to the author, Tommy Hayes, for allowing the recording of his book, What I Came to Tell You, and to Jeff Hart for his rendition of Wayfaring Stranger. This program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina.